Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Simply Bitcoin IRL. Today's going to be a very, very special show. Been looking forward to this one. It is with Jesse Myers. He is the COO of OnRamp Bitcoin and a fellow co-worker at the best place to build your Bitcoin stack, Swan.com, the head of Swan Private, the one, the only, the legendary Stephen Lupka. He has the best posture I've ever seen. It's incredible. Anyways, before we jump into the show, I want to give an awesome shout out to the Bitcoin companies that make this show possible. Of course, Swan Bitcoin, the best place to build your Bitcoin stack. It's being built by Bitcoiners. It's for Bitcoiners. The dollar cost averaging is simple. If you're a high net worth individual, check out Swan Private. What are you waiting for? Visit swan.com today. And of course, the biggest Bitcoin conference on the face of the earth. It's coming up in a week, Bitcoin 2023. It's Miami Beach, Florida, May 18th through the 20th. And you can use the promo code SIMPLY to get yourself a major discount. Anyways, no more delay. Let's bring on these gentlemen on stage. How you doing, boys?
What's going on, Nico? Great to be here.
I clickbaited everybody. This is not a Bitcoin show today, okay? This is a health show. This is Simply Health. We're transitioning. We're only going to be talking about walking and sunlight. And for anyone that doesn't know, Stephen walks 350 miles a month. That is absolutely absurd. He sent me pictures. He has a trail mark, all right? He's creating trail marks on the sidewalks by how much he's walking. But anyways, Stephen, like, we've been going back and forth in private about this. Why don't you tell everybody what is it that you know that not that many people know about walking in sunlight? Why is it so healthy?
All right. I'll give you a quick elevator pitch for all of you Bitcoin people. And we've been DMing about this and you've started walking. So I know you've started walking, Nico. I've been appreciating that. Two main things, right? So they've done studies on all-cause mortality. That's your chance of dying from anything for any reason. If you walk 16,000 steps a day, you would be better off starting to smoke a pack a day than walking 8,000 steps. That's how big that effect is. That 8,000 steps in aggregate outweighs generally what we see from smoking. It's a huge habit. And, you know, beyond just like kind of the health aspect, it keeps your mind clear. And the other benefit, it gets you out in the sun. I think the biggest thing people are sleeping on is how circadian rhythm and our eyes seeing light influence just about everything. It is another one of like the largest causes of death is actually insufficient sunlight now. So I'm a big proponent.
No, and I totally believe it as well, because, you know, like, especially like in countries that are more farther up north, right? You hear a lot about that. You hear a lot about people getting depressed because they don't get that much sunlight. And it's preventative medicine, meaning there's not that much profit in it compared to how the current medical system is today. And you can kind of tie that into fiat. But anyways, before we go down that rabbit hole, Jesse, how you doing? Man, you've been dropping some incredible articles, one of which was retweeted by Michael Saylor. I'm going to read just the headline of this one, which is Bitcoin's full potential valuation. And for anyone who hasn't read this, I highly recommend it. We're going to pull little snippets of it today and we're going to talk about it. But you made the case, the same case that the legendary one and only Hal Finney made many, many years ago when Bitcoin was worth fractions of a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of what it is today. But you still made the case 14 years later that Bitcoin could potentially be a $10 million asset. And the case that you make is that it will take about 25% of the world's wealth. But I hear that number and I feel like it's a big number. And I'm really curious to hear Stephen's thoughts on this as well. So start off with you, Jesse. What inspired you to write that article and what made you so confident about it?
Yeah, awesome. So I'm before Bitcoin, I was a management consultant. And a big part of that is developing the analytical toolkit to go into a problem where it's not clear what the answer is and try to triangulate a reasonable estimate of what an answer is. And so when you're doing that for large businesses, that looks like, you know, coming in to a business unit and they're asking, what's our potential profit if we were to spin up in Asia, you know, start competing there. Don't know. And then you go about trying to figure out reasonable estimates to get some ballpark number. So that's how I think about problems like this. And that's where my brain went immediately when I fell down the Bitcoin rabbit hole of trying to size the opportunity here. And, you know, in the business world, in the consulting world, you talk about full potential. What's the full potential of, you know, of this product, of this business unit, of our profitability? What's the max? What's the ceiling on what's possible here? And so I wanted to do that. And, you know, I was aware of Hal's numbers. And of course, we're all aware of the various huge numbers that people have thrown out over the years about, you know, Bitcoin. You know, there's the stock to flow model of Plan B's handle is 100 trillion, which implies a $5 million per Bitcoin. And then I think he got more bullish than that. So he kind of went even bigger. There's people who have said in the past $100 million per Bitcoin. But there hasn't been like analytical rigor around that. And so I wanted to put some flesh on Hal's idea, really, of what is the role of this asset in the global asset landscape? How big is that total addressable market, first of all? Turns out when you tally up all of the assets out there, there's $900 trillion of assets in the world spread between your various asset buckets like real estate, stocks, bonds, money itself. And Bitcoin is this tiny, tiny little bit, 400 billion in this right now. It's, I guess, closer to the 600 billion, but 0.05%, 1/2,000th of the world's assets is Bitcoin. And obviously, I believe and Bitcoiners believe that because of its superior properties as a store of value asset, as digital gold for the digital age, that 0.05% is going to grow. It's going to take some of the value stored in these other traditional buckets of you know, analog physical store of value assets like real estate or like bonds, and siphon that value away, because every day anyone who's looking at their portfolio and they see I've got, you know, 25% in bonds, do I want to hold that? You know, since we're going into an era of increasing money printing, I believe that bonds will deliver negative real returns over the next decade. And I'd rather own something that's going to deliver a positive return. And I believe because of Bitcoin's properties of increasing scarcity, it will do that. It will be like gold from the 70s with this added rocket fuel of increasing scarcity. Gold in the 70s had a 14x during the stagflation of the 70s because stocks underperformed and everybody wanted hard assets rather than keeping their money in dollars and eating it on inflation. So gold 14x'd in the 70s. I think Bitcoin could do that and some this decade. And so, you know, this whole analysis was to take stock of how early it is still for Bitcoin's position in the global asset landscape, and then put some analytical rigor around where's the ceiling? What percentage of all the assets out there could Bitcoin siphon away over the coming decades? And the answer I came out with was, I think it can reach 25% of all the assets in the world by siphoning away, by causing people to choose, I'd rather not hold bonds. I'm going to sell these bonds and I'm going to buy Bitcoin instead. And that individual decision goes on every day all over the world for everyone. And incrementally, Bitcoin eats more and more of the world's store of value assets. So that would mean going from a 0.05% of the world's assets to 25% of the world's assets would mean a 500x in real terms, inflation adjusted terms, over the coming decades. And I think that's the full potential for what Bitcoin can do.
Yeah, and Steven, pass it on to you as the head of Swan Private. Do you agree with this? Do you agree with this with Jesse's thesis, which is originally Howe's original idea, right? Is, you know, Howe, you know, may he rest in peace. You know, he obviously didn't go in depth, Renny. He broke it down, you know, on a much higher level, like on a much, I don't know what the proper terminology is, but it was more simplistic in the way that he described it. And the reason is simple. Bitcoin wasn't even like, didn't even have value back then, right? So it was just a thought experiment, the way that he approached it. But, you know, Steven, pass it on to you. What are your thoughts on this? When you hear these numbers, do they sound absurd? Like, what is your thinking? Is this something that you bring up to your clients? You know, because one of the talking points that I always hear is like, Nico, you know, I'm too late to Bitcoin. Look at Doge. I can get it for 10 cents on. I don't even know what the price of Doge is, but you guys get my point, right? Absolutely. So, Steven, do you hear this often?
Yeah. So, I mean, I actually really agree with the way of looking at it that Jesse is saying. I've said it kind of in a much simpler way to clients many times. And it's like, do you think it's at all likely that in the future, 2% of people's wealth around the globe might be stored in Bitcoin? Most people, it's like, yeah, that seems reasonable. 1%, 2%. Well, then the price should be substantially higher than here.
That would be a 40x. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's like, that's really simple. Like, could it get to 25, 20? Could it get to 30? I don't even really like try to speculate that far out. But do we think there's a high probability that a couple percent of the world's wealth could end up in Bitcoin over the next decade? Absolutely. Like, and we've done some work on that. So two things. One, it's actually really interesting. I don't have this chart and you may have trouble finding it. So it's a tricky one. But the percentage that gold's market cap was in 1970, or like at the peak of that move, of US assets. And I don't have the number off the top of my head, but if you look this up, it was substantial. It was double digit percentages, I believe, that gold actually represented a huge slice of all US asset value. And so saying, could Bitcoin be 20% of assets? I think that, I mean, that actually is a return to what monetary and asset dynamics looked like, you know, a few decades ago. So is that possible? Of course, that's possible, right?
Yeah.
Will it happen? What timeline? Who knows? But so that's one thing. And then the other thing is, we've actually also been doing some work on this with NakamotoPortfolio.com. So our CIO, Hafa, Alpha Zeta on Twitter, he's built this incredible analytics tool. And with that, you can basically plug in all the asset classes, stocks, real estate, bonds. You can say, what percentage do you think of it is monetary premium, aka people are only buying these things because they don't have a store of value, they don't have something else to hold. And you can kind of run some calculations and you're going to come to similar numbers, you know, depending on what assumptions you plug in. Oh, yeah. And you found this. What was it? It was, okay, so it was 5% of global financial assets. And then, yeah, so it'd be a higher number of US.
Yeah, I think the Peter Thiel put out the slide of in 1980, the total value of all the gold in the world was $2.5 trillion. And all of the equities in the world, all the stocks, was $2.5 trillion. So we were at parity at the end of the stagflation from the 70s. And obviously since then, stocks have grown to $115 trillion and gold has grown to $12 trillion. So 10x outperformance by stocks during this 40-year period of decreasing interest rates and fiat, which I think is set to reverse, and commodities will be the winner this coming decade.
And let me jump in right there with a quick comment, because this might not be on listeners' minds, but one of the arguments that people make frequently is like, oh, if you had like a hard money taking up so much of this value, wouldn't it cripple economic growth? Like, wouldn't that just totally impair everything? 1970s, like, you know, I mean, obviously there was some economic stagflation in that particular era, but that gold relationship had been going on for some time. That wasn't like novel. So you had kind of the US economy from, you know, the early 1900s through, you know, more recently, you had gold as a store of value asset taking up a much more significant slice of all assets. And that was an extremely dynamic period, not just looking at GDP, but because I would honestly, like, you can look at GDP and it, the same argument is still kind of made there and you can see it. But I would even say that the dynamism of that period is more fundamental than what is captured in those GDP metrics, because, you know, you can kind of convert anything into data. But what was really unique about that, you know, mid to late 1900s in America is you saw these huge real world actual strides in technology and living standards and like people's actual lives change. It wasn't just like trade balances and the velocity of money.
Yeah, 100%. Jesse, do you want to go back and forth?
Sure, but on what?
Steven's comments.
Oh yeah, no, I agree with that. I was trying to decide if I had anything to add in terms of the dynamism of the 70s. But yeah, I think that's a fair characterization.
Yeah. So what is the, and to push it onto you guys, of course, we're going down the speculative rabbit hole, but so be it. I think what a lot of people are wondering, and I'm sure you get this question a lot, Stephen, is what is the timeline here? What is the time scale, right? Because it's like, oh, 500X, that's great, you know? But at the same time, are we talking 10 years? Are we talking 20 years? Are we talking 30 years?
Great question.
Yeah.
Would love to jump in there. So I think that as Bitcoiners, we have to be prepared for this to be a generational shift. I think that it just is going to take a long time for people to adjust their unit of account. And that may not even happen, you know, it's not going to happen in the boomers' lifetimes for most boomers. Some boomers have already found Bitcoin and they are setting up their family to you in a great way. Most boomers still think that Bitcoin is a crazy idea.
Hold on a second. Could you define generation? Are we talking about 10, 20 years?
Yeah, I guess 20 years. Typically, like, you know, the baby boomers, Gen X, millennials, Zoomers. I think each generation will have a greater percentage that realizes the value of Bitcoin and opts to include that as a major part of their savings strategy. And then I think what happens is that, so what's the conventional wisdom right now in terms of investing and how to be responsible with your money? It's the 60-40 portfolio. You know, what we've been told by the people that were successful in the last generation is get a mortgage and then put all your money into, you know, 60% stocks, 40% bonds, you'll do great, right? Because that's what worked for them. Because that is the formula that worked great when you start your career in 1981 and interest rates are 15% and a house costs two times your salary. And for, you know, your house costs $50,000 and that was two times your salary. And then over the next 40 years, we've run interest rates down from 15% to 0%. Financial asset valuations skyrocket, meaning your home, the value of your home skyrockets, and the value of your stock portfolio skyrockets too. And so you did great because you happened to choose the right savings vehicles for that era. Now going forward, those are going to underperform. Those savings vehicles have, I think, peaked in relative terms. In nominal terms, they'll still go up. So like the price of the, you know, as we keep printing money, the value of a home in dollar terms will keep going up and people will think they're getting richer the same way that it happened in Weimar Germany. But I think they'll actually be underperforming in real terms over the next few decades. But the winning strategy will be to accumulate hard assets, the things that have underperformed over the last 40 years. And I think we'll set to overperform over the next 40 years. But that means that it's only going to become clear in hindsight, you know, 20, 30, 40 years from now, that the winning strategy all along was to accumulate hard assets like Bitcoin, most notably. Gold will probably do well too. And, you know, on a relative basis, like land will do well as, you know, fairly well. I still think it underperforms Bitcoin and gold. And so it we're still so early in the adoption curve. And that's the other thing that it's hard to remember. There's 4 million addresses with 0.1 Bitcoin or more in them on chain. And if you understand Bitcoin, you have stored your savings on chain. So let's round it up. You know, some people are still going to use exchanges and keep their Bitcoin there. Call it 10 million people actually understand Bitcoin as a part of their savings strategy. 10 million people in the world doing that. There's 2 billion people on the planet with $10,000 or more of net worth. So people who have any money to save, to store in some vehicle. So that is 10 million of 2 billion is 0.5%. So we are currently 0.5% into the technology adoption curve for this savings technology. That's what Bitcoin is at its core. And that puts us in the first fifth of the first category of adopters. We haven't reached the mainstream. We haven't even reached the early adopters. We're in the innovators category and we're still in the first fifth of that. So all of the adoption curve is still to come. And what that means is all the people who in our lives who dismiss it currently haven't included it in their savings strategy and are going to come around because they can't stand missing out at some point. Like, you know, we've had a few data points. There's been three halvings and 3 post-halving bull markets. A year from now, we're going to have the 4th halving, and I believe the 4th post-halving bull market. And some people who regretted being on the sidelines last go-round will dip a toe in this time. And I think we incrementally move through the adoption curve in that way until a generation from now, or maybe it's 30 or 40 years from now, it's the primary way. It's the normal way to store your savings is primarily in Bitcoin and secondarily in these other asset classes like stocks or real estate.
What would your response be to that, Stephen, when you hear Jesse saying that?
Yeah. First of all, I want to say what's up to Dr. Jeff Ross in the comments. Great to see you, man. What would my response be to that? I mean, the original question being timelines, right? I think there's some of these events, I like to think of the world in terms of things which are predictable and things which are non-predictable, right? And I think we often kind of spend time and intellectual energy trying to predict things that are just low probability of us being able to predict to begin with. You know, ultimately, I think Jesse had very reasonable kind of takes and comments there. I would largely agree. But what I would say is like, there are so many events that could happen that could shorten or lengthen that timeline if they were to occur. You know, we've seen there are catalysts in this world, and our ability to predict whether or not those catalysts happen, I think, is low. We have low confidence there. So are there events? Are there certain macroeconomic and financial events that have a non-zero probability that could happen that could expedite that timeline by 90%? Like, yes, those things exist. Are there also events which could impair the whole thing? Like, yes, those two exist. So, you know, if we're not going to kind of get into all of those assessments, for me, it's hard to answer. But if I were just to kind of give my base case, like I would largely agree with Jesse. So it's something where I'm a little skeptical that there's this like flash in the pan, like hyper Bitcoinization over the course of like 1 year, like just everything goes to Bitcoin. I think that's relatively unlikely. I think that's also suboptimal. So I think that would create a lot of like, I don't just mean problems for politicians, but I mean like true geopolitical, political turmoil for average people. I think kind of the slower burn and the more gradual, and what I'm calling gradual, right, could be a decade or two, which is really pretty quick in the larger scheme of things for monetary transitions. But it's the sort of thing that, yeah, I do think it's a slower burn. I think you gradually see people understand it and adopt it. However, you know, looking at like what's going on currently, banking woes, you know, I feel like more and more questions coming to the role of the dollar in global finance. I mean, those are things which could expedite it as well. So it could surprise us. It could be quicker. But it's going to be longer than like a sudden flash in the pan event, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a great distinction of like, I don't think there's a flash in the pan either. And I think that we forget, and we do ourselves a disservice by forgetting this, that I think this is hyper Bitcoinization. It doesn't feel like it on a day-to-day basis, but like this is as fast as the world can transition from one monetary norm to another. And I think, thank goodness that Satoshi created these 4-year intervals, because you can, humans, businesses, we can incorporate that change and grow like really like tree rings, where you have a halving, and then there's a bull market because of the supply shock, and there's expansion and growth. There's, you bring in a whole bunch of people. Of course, it turns into mania and you crash on the backside of that. And then you've got the bear market, which is winter and hardening and developing, and individuals need that. They need to build their conviction in why they're holding this asset. And I think even more importantly is the businesses in Bitcoin need to be building out the infrastructure to accommodate the next incremental slice of adopters. And that is, you know, a 4-year timeline is as fast as you can really realistically go in terms of that human process of allowing Bitcoin to go in your mind and in your life to go from nothing, to go from something that doesn't matter at all, to become the savings vehicle that you've organized your life around. So we're living through hyper Bitcoinization right now, and maybe that's a 20-year thing, maybe it's a 40-year thing, but in the scale of human history, it's lightning fast, because you know humans have been using physical money for 70,000 years at least. That's the earliest indication of shell money. And then we used physical money, hard money, for all of human history up until 50 years ago, when we went off the gold standard in 1971. And we've been living in this tiny little window of fiat money ever since, that we've forgotten is abnormal. So, you know, now we're living in this once in a species transition. That's why my newsletter is called Once in a Species, from analog money, how humanity has developed and civilization, like the basis of civilization, from analog money to digital hard money. And 20, 30 years is a blink of an eye on that timescale.
Yeah. And let's talk about and you were touching upon it, Jesse, right? Which is this idea of slowly but surely people will start to wake up to that. And, you know, due to my daily live show, I'm a slave to the news cycle. But it's so incremental. It's ever so slow, but slowly but surely, I personally call it the Bitcoin echo chamber. It's starting to break at the seams, and people are starting to ask very basic questions. My highlight really like of the last 2 or 3 weeks is you have one of the most popular mainstream podcasters called Tim Pool. And on his show, he was covering New Republic Bank and it going under and all this crazy stuff. At the very end, he's like, guys, I don't want to give you financial advice, but I don't want to tell you what you should do, but I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to buy Bitcoin, right? So slowly but surely, that's starting to kind of, the Bitcoin echo chamber is slowly starting to break. And then Steven, you were featured in CNBC today in regards to Bitcoin responding favorably to today's CPI print. Is that part of the process? Are people waking up to Bitcoin when they think of that? What's your take?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a few things I could highlight there. One is actually the question that Warren Buffett was asked at his recent seminar, symposium, whatever you call it, meeting. And you had this, you probably saw it online for those that didn't, you had this like 13 or 16 year old girl basically come up and ask him about like, what does he think of the status of the US dollar as global reserve currency? Like the subtext being, do you think that's in jeopardy? And his answer, to like summarize it very quickly, was like, it's not looking good. The fact that he gave that answer, the fact that he was asked that question, it's like a containment breach where that discussion was previously limited to like certain pockets of like macroeconomic finance, Twitter, gold bugs, Bitcoiners. And that is now, you know, kind of, there's been a containment breach. Now, is that me saying the dollar is going to lose its role as global reserve overnight? Of course not. There's been many kind of false starts and proclamations there, but you're seeing those concerns, I think, radiate outward into kind of like concentric rings of institutional legitimacy. And that's part of this process too. You know, as far as kind of other comments, yeah, I mean, people are just talking about it more. Grants, which is an interest rate observer, they've been publishing for decades, probably like close to 100 years. I might have it wrong. But they recently had a whole kind of part in their newsletter, in their dispatch about Bitcoin. And the fact that they're even writing about it at all is one of these signposts. I think discussion is getting larger. You know, I think it is spreading. I think we're seeing adoption. We're also seeing that manifest in the Bitcoin community itself. And what I'm saying there is I've kind of watched this with a lot of curiosity that from the time I got into Bitcoin to now, it's gotten so much broader, right? You have these different factions within Bitcoin. You have progressives that really like Bitcoin now. You have academics that really like Bitcoin. It's become very broad. And to me, that's what mass adoption looks like. There is no mass adoption if your community stays kind of narrow. That's a specialization, right? And so seeing this expand and seeing all of these different voices and, some of these, the BPI guys are phenomenal. I'm thinking of like Troy Cross and Andrew Bailey and Craig Warmke. They're all PhDs. They're all professors that have, yeah, literally Troy had a tweet that was like, Bitcoin gave me a new life. It gave me meaning and purpose. And, you know, these are guys that like, you know, maybe wouldn't have been in like the 2013 cohort, but we're seeing that now. We're seeing Bitcoin reach out and connect with people and motivate people. And to me, this is adoption, right? Like that is what it looks like. So, you know.
Yeah. No, and I completely agree. And then it really helps us also just, you know, Bitcoiners are just sitting, you know, protected by their orange force field. The longer you've been on a Bitcoin standard, the easier it becomes to hodl, you know, especially if you've been through a couple cycles and you're watching either Janet Yellen or Jerome Powell try to, you know, they asked him a very simple question, like, why 2% inflation? And the mental gymnastics that he went through to try to explain that. And you're just watching.
Do you know where it came from?
No idea.
It came from a random comment by a New Zealand central banker many decades ago. It was like random off the cuff. Just like, we're going to target 2%. And it was one of those weird stories where it got enshrined.
And they call us a cult. They're the cult. All right. But anyway, so we had, and that's so interesting. So we have Jerome Powell, and then you have Janet Yellen being like basically questioned about why she was bailing out the big banks and what would the unintended consequences of that be affecting the community banks. But what's really interesting is some comments that came from an anti-Bitcoin congressman. His name is Brad Sherman, and he had some comments. I'm going to play the video, and I want to get your guys' thoughts on this.
Crypto bros make money literally by making money, and they've made over $1 trillion out of thin air. They'll accuse the U.S. government of making money out of thin air. Maybe we do, but we're the U.S. government.
Wow. I hadn't seen that. That's great. Yeah.
Maybe we do, but we're the U.S. government. And then this kind of reminds me of, I have this tweet pinned on the top of my Twitter, and I definitely took a lot of influence from Ayn Rand. And I basically said, I refuse to work for money that another man can create for free. I don't care that you're the U.S. government. Yeah. I don't care. You know, the fact that you can just literally create money for free that everyone's putting time and energy and work and all this stuff into. And then not to mention all the unintended consequences of having a system that is completely misaligned, right? Whether that's the corruption in politics down your alley, Stephen, and I'm sure you've gone down this rabbit hole, and we should definitely take the conversation this direction, and what's that's done to health as well, right? It's misaligned the incentives of society in general as a whole, in the pharmaceutical industry as well. You guys remember the food pyramid? Do you remember we were taught that in school as if it was a fact, as if it was there's a reason it was the true thing? Yeah. Anyways, Stephen, do you have any thoughts on Representative Sherman?
So I want to just real quick. So I'm going to call out John Haar here, who's part of the Swan private team. He's one of the MDs at Swan. He was forever radicalized by the food pyramid. The food pyramid was the single thing which broke his trust in institutions and has never recovered. It was too far for him. So what's up, John? Do I have comments on Sherman? So, you know, I think, you know, it can seem like kind of this like gotcha, like, oh my God, they admitted they're just printing money from thin air. But like, I think the thing to keep in mind is like, that's the deal. Like, no, like that's the system, right? And like, it's their argument. Like, if we were to have them on here, Sherman, or maybe someone smarter than Sherman who could articulate what he really means, they would argue essentially that, yeah, we might be printing money from thin air, but the system works, doesn't it? That's the argument. And so, you know, if the system did work, if that were true, and the US government printing money from thin air was the most efficient system we could have for economic growth and human well-being, well, then it wouldn't matter as much, right? You could make kind of a moral argument, but you know, if it was the best system and if it did produce the most economic growth, you could be like, hey, okay, that's pretty legitimate. Like the argument we have to make is that it's not, that's not true. That's not true at all. And the issue is not, it's not that you do it. It's not that you print the money. It's that the act of printing the money distorts. I've always framed this as it distorts the amount of information embedded in the system. And so when you think of like complex systems and you think of these very dynamic, emergent, complex systems where a lot of spontaneous order manifests. So an economy is one of those. It's why the Soviet Union failed, right? They had an emergent, dynamic, spontaneously ordered system, the economy, that they tried to control from the top down. Another example is an ecosystem. You can't plan a forest. They tried in Germany. It was a disaster. And so you can kind of look at those systems and say that there is embedded information. There is intelligence within the system. And my argument with the money printing is that it distorts and impairs the inherent information processing in the complex system that is our economy. And so the money printing is bad because it is not the best system. It doesn't work the best. It distorts incentives. It distorts capital formation. And it impairs this kind of complex machinery that we all rely on, not just to live, but to move civilization forward. And this goes to your point, Nico, of like these other deteriorations of health and culture and, you know, like beautiful buildings and all of these things that, you know, you walk through. This is another John Haar shout out, but like you walk through New York City, and if you see a beautiful building, like a truly beautiful building, a building which like the creators obviously cared about the aesthetics, it's detailed, it's carved, it's beautiful. And you look up when it was built It's always before 1930. John has like a, he's going to do a whole thread on this, but he photographs them and he checks their construction date. And so coming back to my point about the progress of civilization, right? Like these incentives and this machinery, the system and the information embedded in it, like as this gets distorted, as it collapses, as it becomes less efficient and less organic, like you see this like thrust of civilization start to deteriorate in some ways. And it's broad. We've talked about this before. I'm not comfortable reducing it all down to the money. And I think there's actually a loss of like literally like a metaphysical void. I think there is a complete deconstruction of metaphysics and values. There's kind of the postmodern condition. I think that played a huge role. But, you know, we can talk about the monetary side of it. And you just see the civilizational engine get impaired. And I'm highlighting that, you know, making a long point, but I'm highlighting that because it's not just about everybody having a good GDP growth. It's not just about like enough stuff, right? Like stuff is relatively hollow. If you're starving, yeah, you want more stuff. But to say that the only point of human civilization is to create enough material goods for us all to be satiated, it misses the mark of what it means to be human. And what it means to be human is the advancement of culture, of aesthetics, of art, of purpose, of having a cohesive cultural engine that actually moves us into the future. And so far from just impairing the economic conditions, I actually think it has impaired our cultural standing and our cultural engine.
100%. And I love what you said about postmodernism. And I would even say that fiat breeds nihilism, which is, you know, I would connect it with postmodernism. And I would even go a level below that. And I would say that the specific, not to get into any specifics on Simply Bitcoin, we don't lean left or right. We are on the party of orange versus the party of green. But that being said, that specific ideology, the postmodernist ideology and the nihilism that comes with it, I think it's only viable with a money printer. Once you take the money printer out of that equation, I don't think that specific political ideology is politically viable or economically viable. They need to be able to have effective redistribution mechanisms, one of which is obviously taxation. That's a whole other rabbit hole. You know, people feel strongly about that. But the one that they really get away with and the one that they really use is the hidden tax, which is the hidden tax of inflation, right? And I think a lot of people are rightly so very upset, specifically the younger generations. They really feel like they got the short end of the stick. And I think that they inherently know in their hearts that something is wrong, but they continue to seek a political solution to which there is none. The solution is the separation of money and state entirely. Yeah. Steven, what are your thoughts on that? And then we'll pass it on to Jesse.
Yeah. You know, no, exactly. Because it's the machinery. It's the system itself, not in a political sense, but like the information of the complex emergent machine has been impaired, right? So like, exactly. You try to impose a political solution on that. It doesn't work. I would actually say, I would like to draw like a connection. I think the line between the kind of thread that connects postmodernism and fiat is that fiat is a natural money under postmodernism. What does that mean and why am I saying it? So if I'm gonna, and my God, if anybody listens to this, like there's so much contentious debate on like, what is postmodernism? Like, shut up. Like, you guys know what I'm talking about. People that listen to it, that we critique that. Generally, broadly speaking, postmodernism argues against kind of the inherency or like the inherent realness of things, that things are essentially constructed in many ways through our culture, through our thoughts, through our beliefs, and they lack inherent reality. There's like this sort of notion of like objective reality got eaten away at. And so under an ideology, under a philosophy where everything is essentially constructed by man, there are no outside realities, there's no inherent realities, why, like, the fiat is a natural money because it's saying money is not real. Money has no external reality. Money is a social construct in that sense, right? And to some degree, you know, to throw them their bone, to some degree it is, right? Because why does Bitcoin have value? Well, because in part, we accept it as money. Like, there is a social element to money, but that's not the whole of it. And they mistake it as like the whole of it, that that's all that money is. That's a part of what money is, but it's more than that. And the other reasons Bitcoin has value are because of its inherent objective qualities, such as its decentralization, such as its ability to transfer and store. Like, those are not constructed. Those are real realities, and they're part of what gives it value. But so fiat becomes a natural money under a society where the very notion of truth and the very notion of objective reality becomes chipped away at, questioned, and dismantled until you have a crisis of faith. And what is the crisis of faith in? The crisis of faith is in, you know, belief itself. There is a question of belief itself. And so fiat becomes the natural money in that, because it is a nihilistic money. It is an arbitrary money. It is a money that says none of this is real. Money is balance sheet points. It's MMT, right? It's just accounting points. And we create it at whim to service what is effectively central planning objectives.
100%. 100%. And what's interesting to me is, to add to your point, Stephen, is what happens to individuals. You can even talk about it on a nation state level as well. What Nayib Bukele is doing in El Salvador is absolutely incredible. And you could tell that it's changing the system from within, right? It just, you know, CK, general manager of Bitcoin Magazine, good friend of mine, the analogy, the way that he described it, I want to get your thoughts on this, Jesse, is Bitcoin changes your operating system. And all of a sudden, even with people, this is why we try so hard on Simply to not get stuck in the left and right dichotomy and then the bullshit, right? We just, what he said, he's like, look, Bitcoin fundamentally changes your operating system. And people that are still on the fiat operating system, they're on a nihilistic operating system. They're on a materialistic operating system. They're on an operating system that's inherently disconnected from reality, unlike Bitcoin, that is connected to reality via proof of work, right? Is anchored to the universe, to energy. And it completely changes your perspective on life. And then all of a sudden, the different ideological beliefs don't matter anymore. The Bitcoin becomes the great unifier. And I've seen hardcore libertarian Bitcoiners get along with hardcore socialist Bitcoiners, and they get along because they have that common denominator, and that common denominator is Bitcoin. So Jesse, what are your thoughts on this conversation? I know we got sidetracked a little bit, but I'm really enjoying this. I read quite a lot about this subject, Stephen, and I do find it very fascinating.
I told Jesse ahead of time I was going to sidetrack this conversation.
this is in my wheelhouse too. I wrote a piece on deflation versus inflation and what it means for civilization, and talked a lot about how peak of art and architecture was the end of the Gilded Age, turn of the century, 1900 or so. And so I think that what CK was getting at about how it changes your operating system, that's the core of it, is that The norm is living on an inflationary unit of account, and that creates this flywheel constantly of things get worse over time because a dollar gets you less, and so producers, to keep their costs the same, have to cut their inputs, cut the quality of their goods. That's where shrinkflation comes from. It's why service seems to get worse over time, because businesses are trying to get by with the same costs when all the costs around them are going up. So that's an inflationary world. Everything gets worse, and that's especially felt when it comes to craftsmanship. In the built environment, when it comes to art and quality of goods as well. You know, a kitchen appliance, a fridge from the 1950s can still work. And, you know, nowadays we have planned obsolescence in our appliances because we need to feed the fiat machine. And so you have to keep purchasing things. So going from that norm, which creates this nihilism and defeatism, really, of especially in younger generations, you can't buy a starter home here in Los Angeles is $1 million. And, you know, that's a pretty backbreaking for a young person. And so what do you do instead? You orient your life around experiences. You know, you go to Coachella, and that costs $1,000 rather than $1 million. And you make that your identity, but then you're living for the moment. And that's fiat world. And then when you make this transition to the Bitcoin world, now you're on a deflationary standard. Your money gets more valuable over time. It can buy you more goods in the future than it can today. And that changes everything. And it's this really hard process. Like, it's a bumpy process. There's a lot of personal volatility and like tension and cognitive dissonance as you go through this transition from fiat world to Bitcoin world and embrace this deflationary unit of account. And the result of that is, like, in a deflationary world, goods get better over time. In the same way that goods get worse over time, when you're using an inflationary unit of account, goods get better over time with Bitcoin. So, and that happened on the gold standard. That happened, you know, we had 150 years in the U.S. After the American Revolution, up until the creation of central banking, and in that window, prices were stable, but because it was all pegged to gold, the value of the price of everything was relatively stable for 150 years. But during that, you have technological deflation, as Jeff Booth would point out. So the ability to create goods gets cheaper. It's easier to create goods, but you want to keep your prices the same, so you make those goods better. And so everything gets better over time on just a gold standard, which is flat. And here's Bitcoin, where it's a massively deflationary standard. And that's going to be an incredible thing for the world, even though it's really bumpy to transition from this worldview of nihilism and chasing for the moment and living for experiences and shifting towards a future-oriented worldview where you're planning, you're saving for the future because you know how much it's going to be worth in the future. And that's how humanity should be. That's investing on an individual scale. And that's a good force for humanity and for the world in general. And, you know, I just think about the Bitcoin future as this bright, glowing, sunlit place that is full of hope and optimism and prosperity and planning for the future.
Yeah, 100%. It completely changes, and I love the way that you broke it down about how the younger generation are living in the moment. And a little bit of a troll, but I'm also being serious, right? You know, if you have the Bitcoin conference, and of course, you know, the Pacific Bitcoin Festival, right? And these are festivals and conferences of freedom and prosperity and optimism about the future. NVK's handle is called Deterministic Optimism. I love that when, you know, you're living on a Bitcoin standard. But on the other side of the world, in Davos, they also have a conference called the World Economic Forum. And the reason I'm bringing that up, right, is because their own slogans are even saying the quiet part out loud. They're telling you, you'll own nothing and you'll be happy, right? So they're describing, Jesse, what it is, what they're describing, the situation that of which they created themselves. By the way, did you guys know that the World Economic Forum was founded in 1971? Check it right now.
I did know that. Yep.
It literally... Reality is stranger than fiction. Anyways, so, you know, not to get into the any of the crazy stuff, but I guess what I'm trying to say is you clearly have these two very, very, very different systems. And I think at this point, advocating for the system that steals from you, which is the system of fiat, the future iteration of what they want that system to be, which is central bank digital currencies and all the godlike, all even more godlike powers that's going to give these bureaucrats in order to, you know, centrally try to centrally plan society to create this. I don't even want to go down that rabbit hole, but you guys know where I'm going with this. And then the other option is Bitcoin, right? Where the individual, by taking back monetary sovereignty, by taking self-custody, you have to take self-custody, that's step one, right? Gets to have the ability to plan for the future, which I think was completely robbed. It was stolen from us. If you're under the age of 35, I said this at Pacific Bitcoin, you don't own anything. You don't own anything. You can't own anything. You've been outpriced. You said LA. I live in Miami. It's nuts, right? The you know, real estate here. So unless like you're ultra successful or you're very privileged or you got into Bitcoin early, you know, you're gonna stay a renter for the rest of your life. And that kind of changes your mental perception of life. And it's what you said, Jesse. What is the natural knee-jerk reaction to that? Let me just buy ticket in Miami. It's Ultra Music Festival. Yeah. Let me just spend $1,000, get VIP tickets to Ultra. Might as well do that because this is hopeless, you know. And I think kind of tie this in with Michael Saylor's domain, which he's been sitting on for quite a long time. If you go to hope.com, it takes you to a Bitcoin educational website. I think Bitcoin is that. Bitcoin is hope, and Corey says it best. You know, Bitcoin will lead us to the bright orange future. Steven, you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I actually think that part of this whole thread you guys are pulling on is that under fiat and the nihilism that is so prevalent in society and under kind of like reductionistic materialism, right? So like, you know, nihilism, like kind of there's no inherent values, nothing matters in a certain sense. And reductionistic materialism, all that exists, the only thing that matters is like the things in front of us, the objects that matter. The only inevitable outcome of that is consumerism, right? It is just like, well, if nothing really matters in any sort of inherent way, and the only thing that exists in this world is stuff, then I'm just going to go get stuff. I'm just going to go do stuff. I'm going to acquire things. And so not only do I see like Bitcoin, I agree with you guys that like Bitcoin and a hard money standard, it has this influence on stuff, on the things we build. They become better over time. They become beautiful. They kind of, it reverses some of this like really, really, you know, poor consumerism. But I actually think that the more profound thing is that the focus on the quality of our stuff is itself fiat. Like, is itself a byproduct of that? And if you look at really healthy, thriving civilizations, they're not as concerned with stuff. There are these higher order virtues. There are these higher order sources of meaning and purpose where stuff takes a bit of a backseat. It's not that you don't want good things, and not that these civilizations didn't produce beautiful or powerful material objects and systems, but that is not the driving orientation of one's life. The point of a good human life is not to acquire the best things, to have the most stuff or the highest or even the most beautiful stuff, even the most functional stuff, but it is to spend one's life in the pursuit of something which transcends oneself, to spend one's life in the pursuit of virtue, of meaning, of purpose, of the cultivation of the self. And what I actually hope is that far from just being something which improves our economic system, it will. I actually hope that, you know, in this resolution, society actually reorients from the material to let's call these things like transcendental, right? To virtue, to meaning, to purpose, to these forces which transcend simply being purely material and, you know, inundate and enervate the human life with vitality, right? Like that's the civilizations I look back on where you can see kind of the primacy and the importance to which these transcendent concerns flowed in and through society. And I think just limiting or focusing or centering the discussion of how a hard money standard improves our material culture, I think actually runs through the same outcomes of where fiat has got us, where the only thing we can see, like our vision has become grounded. We're at the base level of the forest or the mountain, and all we can see is this one layer. And, you know, I think it actually, there's this opportunity to rise up and to see from a different vantage point.
100%. And I love what you said about purpose. I wrote an article for Scylla 21. I don't write very often. This is one of the only articles I wrote, and apparently it resonated with a lot of people because it got me invited to podcasts. But the name of the article is Bitcoin Gave Me Purpose. I don't think human beings, I think you need a reason to get up in the morning. Yes. Like even if you're very wealthy, like even if you don't have to work, you know, say retire, whatever it is you want to call it.
Yeah.
You still need a reason to get up. You still need a reason to live. I think it's hardwired in human beings, right? And I think in this postmodernist world that we live in, it's almost like, no, you don't need that. You know, you can replace that with Netflix and chill. You can replace that by watching the game. You can replace that by buying the latest, I don't even know, because I'm so disconnected from that world. The latest Louis V bag. I don't know, dude. I literally have 30 of these sweaters and I rotate them every single day. I just don't care. I'm at that point. I really do believe that without a purpose, you know, are you really living?
Yeah.
Are you absolutely really living? Yeah. Right.
There's a battle over the very definition of the human condition, right? And the kind of opposing side in many ways has used a tricky tactic, which is, essentially to say that it doesn't matter, that us striving to answer the question, what is the point? Who are we after all? What does it mean to be human? For that to be decentered, to be removed from focus as like the relevancy of everything we do. Schrodinger had a phenomenal quote that basically said as much and said that like, if the point of your science is not, and Schrodinger was like one of the preeminent scientists of the early 1900s, I believe, real titan. He said, if the point of your science is not to answer Plutonius's question, which is, and who are we after all? That if science, if our philosophy, if our economy, if our culture, if the end result of all of that striving, if all of those efforts is not to try to define, to illuminate the human condition and who are we after all? And the answer to that can never be found in 5% year over year GDP growth. You can fuck right off. Like you cannot find that there.
I finally have something to disagree with Stephen on.
Ooh.
Yeah. I think the Maslow's pyramid, the striving for the top, is a noble ideal, and a way to find fulfillment. But I think that what Bitcoin gives to the world is an engine to help satisfy the lower tiers of Maslow's pyramid for so many people in the world that currently don't have those things fully met. And that through 5% GDP growth, that, you know, just take the microcosm of like what Bitcoin can do in terms of the energy grid for in a place like Africa. places where, let's say, you don't currently have clean drinking water. And then because of Bitcoin mining, you can create a local grid based on unused hydropower, which can allow for other industrial applications to show up, create industry in that location, and develop the kind of infrastructure necessary to make it worthwhile to have a water system where you have clean drinking water. And suddenly you've elevated the quality of life for this whole region. And I think that happens through the GDP growth that Bitcoin makes possible. And so I think it's like, yes, the pyramid, Maslow's apex is the, you know, it's nirvana. It's the aspiration of everyone, self-actualization. It should be, and it can be, and the transcendentalists were all about that for good reason. But then how do you get there? How do you get 8 billion people to a place where they can focus on that higher aspiration? And I think that Bitcoin is, you know, through 5% GDP growth, makes it possible to get there.
Steven?
So I would say that I definitely agree with you that Bitcoin covers the real lack, the real material lack for so many. And that's a huge positive. That's hugely important. And that can be a barrier. I would say that not having enough will prevent you from rising, but it will not cause you to rise to have enough. And so what I'm really kind of getting at is not that people cannot be impaired, but that making the world more productive on its own will not shift this. It will not shift this cultural focus in a sense. And, you know, the evidence I would put forward is like, you have a country and like, you can even kind of just, let's just look at the top 30% of Americans, some of the most prosperous people who have ever lived. And they're all mired in nihilism, in purposelessness. Yep. So
right.
On its own, it won't. But if it's not there, yes, it will impair you. So I think we're aligned. It's just different.
Yeah. And I think that the top 30%, the top 1% of wealth in America, they're still subject to the same culture, the same chasing dollars, the same nihilism that comes out of a century of fiat, I mean, 50 years in particular of social decay from this flywheel of everything getting worse over time. And then you switch over to this other thing where you sort of bootstrap the conditions of the Gilded Age again. And of course, technology is going to make that different. It's not like we're going to go back in time in terms of the quality of goods and politics and all that. And in fact, we're going to have bigger problems with the panopticon potential, given how capable technology is now, especially with AI. But hopefully, hopefully humanity can navigate all that and get onto this positive flywheel of things getting better over time. Which will reinstill the values that have eroded away over time, in terms of aesthetic goods, but also family values. Because, you know, if you're optimistic about the future, you have a family and you care about that family and you're investing in, your kids. And I think it strengthens communities to be living around a bunch of families that have family values. And so we can bootstrap a positive flywheel that can, lead us back to a place where we can start to aspire to the transcendentalist ideals again, when currently we're preoccupied with the rat race.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Anyways, gentlemen, it's been an honor and a privilege to have you both. I really, really enjoyed where this conversation went. Thank you both of you for coming on. So I'm going to go, Steven, why don't you tell everybody a little bit about Swan Private, a little bit about yourself, and guys, if you want an optimistic Twitter account to follow, inspirational, I might add, in terms of health and wealth are kind of the same thing, right? And just inspirational in terms of, you know, just walking, getting sun, you know, doing the basics that I think a lot of people forget because, you know, they're in office or, you know, they're getting lost in the sauce of life. I really, really recommend Steven's Twitter. At least to me, it's been an inspiration. I consider also Steven a friend. And of course, we work together at Swan. So, Steven, why don't you tell everybody where they could find you on the interwebs and a little bit about Swan Private?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would just search my full name on Twitter, Steven Lubka, L-U-B-K-A. The handle is Zambala Hoddle, but you won't be able to spell that. Yeah, and so glad to connect on Twitter. I run the private team for Swan. And so private is our concierge team for high net worth investors, for businesses, you know, corporations, trusts, family offices, retirement products, all those sort of things, all the kind of more advanced kind of offerings. We have the leading concierge service in the industry. What does that really mean? It means that like every private client, they get a dedicated representative that they can text or call, get on the phone with. Like we walk people through Bitcoin and hold their hand. And it's been incredibly impactful for you know, for our clients, our users, and the people that have chosen to trust us and work with Swan, because there's so many people out in the world that if they don't have someone to hold their hand, they're not going to adopt Bitcoin now. They're going to wait, right? It still takes a level of, you know, of being a little, taking a little risk of doing something new, of stepping outside of the box to really go into Bitcoin now and really make a significant position. And for a lot of people, they want to know that they're in good hands and that there's someone they can call and talk to. And that's what we've built with Swan Private. I've led the team since day one. So, you know, it's been a pleasure to spin it up and pleasure that, you know, I mean, an honor that Corey trusted me to do that. It's grown tremendously. We also put out research. We have in-person events in Miami and LA for private clients. Swan Conference. So if you got questions, email me at steven@swanbitcoin. If you guys are going to be in Miami, the private team is going to be down in Miami. Definitely come. We have a booth. We're going to be at events. So reach out. We'll definitely be tweeting about it. Pleasure to be here.
Awesome. Thanks, Steven. And Jesse, why don't you tell everybody where they can find you on the interwebs? And also, man, this is the first time we've really got into chat on a podcast. So it's truly an honor to have you on. I'm a huge fan of your work. I've read it multiple times. And thank you, man. Really appreciate you coming.
Oh, my pleasure to be here. Yeah, it's been fun to do this for the first time. Hopefully come back again. People can find me. There's my handle, Croesus, BTC. I have a newsletter that I write called Once in a Species. You can find that at onceinaspecies.com, where I put out Bitcoin educational content and Bitcoin and macro updates weekly. You can sign up for free and get that in your inbox. And I also am the co-founder and COO of OnRamp Bitcoin, which is a Bitcoin trust. So what we have set up over the last 8 months and have only recently launched about a month ago publicly is a trust that is designed by Bitcoiners to do what Grayscale has done, but try to do it better than Grayscale. So the gold standard is still self-custody of your Bitcoin, and Swan Bitcoin is a fantastic way to acquire your Bitcoin and get ready for self-custody. But there are a lot of people out there who end up getting exposure to Bitcoin via trust products like Grayscale. And these trust products are designed to not let people withdraw their Bitcoin and take self-custody. And so what we've done is set up OnRamp Bitcoin as a trust vehicle where if you're not yet ready to do self-custody, but you want exposure to Bitcoin and you want to make sure that you can take self-custody further down the road, you can come in with us, get your exposure, have it sit in the trust. And then when you're ready, in a few years, you know, when you're ready to handle cryptographic materials, you can take self-custody and withdraw your Bitcoin and you know, be on your own from that point on in terms of security and safekeeping. So you can find that at onrampbitcoin.com, and you can reach out and schedule a time to chat with us.
Well, like I said, Jesse, Stephen, thank you so much for joining me today on Simply Bitcoin IRL. If you guys don't mind, hang out in the back for a second. I'm going to close it. Guys, thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Simply Bitcoin IRL. We'll be back tomorrow in the live show. Corey has me doing things, so I'm going to have Opti and Mike, our own Mike Hobart, fill in. But we will be back in the live show 12:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for another episode of Simply Bitcoin Live. Until then, guys, enjoy the rest of your night. We'll see you tomorrow. Peace out.